In closing, we believe that this bill somewhat reflects our conclusions, and because of that, we really urge its consideration.
Thank you. Questions? Anything on Mark?
You'd have to agree, though, wouldn't you, that other than for the addition of the two sales positions, that prior to 1981, Prison Industries had the authority to enter into agreements with other governmental units to do exactly what they did at Rogue Community College and the Jackson County Justice Center.
The marketing goals, as established by the Oregon Prison Advisory Committee, various goals were listed. And in the goals, they listed competition in the public market and outside competition as some of their latter choices of avenues of to get business. We believe that Senate Bill 891, because of their outside sales, put them in a much more favorable position to compete outside of the public arena.
But you mean to compete for other government business?
Not just government business, but that gave them a lot of latitude in competing with the private industries.
Oh, I would agree with you there in the private sector. And I'm saying that insofar as Prison Industries was authorized to enter into contracts with other government entities for the provision of cabinet work, furniture, and the like, that authority existed before Senate Bill 891.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's absolutely correct. 891, either consciously or subconsciously, though, had the effect of putting them into high-grade competition, regardless of, you know, its effect was on public contracts.
What goods come to your mind that they could produce over there that would not be in competition with Oregon products?
The first ones...
Well, we gave that some consideration because we thought if we're going to offer our services to find products outside the area, we should talk about it a little bit. Just a couple items just calling to mind were, for instance, cabinet hardware, which is almost exclusively shipped in from out of state.
Light fixtures.
Light fixtures is another that are not produced readily in this area. We had considered going to, for instance, Oregon State University, University of Oregon, Portland State, and asking their economic research people to help us or to assist us in Oregon Prison Industries in coming up with items.
Thank you. House Bill 2574, Mr. Watson, Mr. Penn, would you like to vote the book together?
Bob Watson, Administrator of the Correction Division, here to testify in favor of House Bill 2574. With me at the table is Gary Kahns, and we've had considerable discussion about the merits and the possibilities that the idea of lease purchase would provide. For some time, we've hoped that we could create in the state a broader or longer menu of ways that we could approach the problems of crowding and space needs. It runs beyond state government, of course, to all levels of government, and the bill that has been introduced is really specific to the Corrections Division, but if we examine its application together with some of the things we discussed this afternoon in the full committee of House Judiciary, we might be able to see some relief not only for the state but also for counties and, for instance, a regional facility. Representative Donna Zajon called me late this afternoon and said she had a conflict and couldn't be here and asked me if I would speak on the bill. So prior to Darrell Rawls leaving the state, he had worked with us in examining the merits or problems with the idea of lease purchase, and he re-identified three things that I think I should raise as issues so you know what we're dealing with. Darrell said the biggest obstacle he saw was a, quote, walk-away provision that no long-term debt in excess of $50,000 may be incurred by any legislative assembly. So there's some need to address that in any lease purchase in order to make sure that investors could see the value of a construction, for instance, of a prison. And because of that walkaway provision, then we in corrections need to look at the question of what other alternative uses could be made of the building in its original design so it is not exclusively a jail or a prison. And we were prepared to examine what that might mean, and for instance, security. If the building could later be used for a factory or an office building or whatever, what designs might be possible. Well, in the bond measure, the last bond measure that was considered, we had a symposium of architects brought in who examined that question of, are there ways that you can create a prison so that you could walk away from it and find the investors with something that could be used for another purpose, and they assured us they could. Removable cells, for instance, and the hardware of a prison could be taken out of the building, so you just have the shell left, so it could be used for a factory or an office. So that problem, which Darrell saw as a major obstacle, I think could be overcome. Another question, if it's constructed on state-owned land or government-owned land, which is likely to happen, is another problem, but I think could be addressed in some way that by agreements, at least Darrell saw it could be addressed by agreements that the, even though it's difficult, it could be overcome or it could be built on private land, I guess, which would be their alternative. But I guess the third thing, one of the real obstacles, I guess, to this, as well as to bond measures, is that it's very much more expensive than just appropriating the money out of the general fund. The reason for the attractiveness of the measure is that investors make money. It's 2 to 4 times more, perhaps, than what it would cost if you could finance the prisoners from existing funds. But even with all those concerns, and I've raised the problems first, I would recommend that this be added to the statutes of the state of Oregon so that we would have it available in the event everything else fails. We need to look to this source of funding to create space in the state. And I've received several letters from large banking firms that are willing to enter into discussions with the state of Oregon in the event this law does become available to them as a way to pursue construction in the state. So for all those reasons, I think it's meritorious and ought to be added. We have no plans immediately to begin pursuing it and using it, but I think it would be helpful perhaps to other units of government that are interested in this approach, that here's a policy statement of the state of Oregon that would say that this is a reasonable thing to do.
Right, thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, House Judiciary Committee, my name is Gary Kunz, and I'm the newly elected, or the new fellow in office, so to speak, for the County Commission for Marion County. Don St. John has also called me in very late in the evening, I might add, same as Bob, to testify on this piece of legislation, and I imagine that one of the reasons that she did that is I'm partially responsible for the concept that's rightly or wrongly. This concept of the bill leaseback option to purchase resulted in, after the defeat of the $60 million bond issue back in May of 82, most of you are familiar with that. Since that time, I personally have spent a lot of time in researching, investigating, discussing, etc., the concept of the bill leaseback option to purchase for jails and or prisons. And that comes from the background of, my background is finance and development. There are other states that are doing this too. The states are namely right now Washington and California. When I say we, Mr. Watson, Mr. Toombs, Mr. Belkway, Mr. Coleman from Corrections Division have discussed the concept. Also, Darrell Rawls of General Service Department have discussed this concept. The Marion County Board of Commission, and that's my other two colleagues, are looking very seriously at putting this type of a project together in our particular county. And most of you have read about it and heard about it, and the board will probably recommend that Marion County build a new facility. We have no choice in that matter. We're going to have to. and that decision has already been made for us. This legislation, as I understand it, would make it possible for the contractual, as Mr. Watson has indicated, arrangements with the private investor, developer, and that particular government agency. The concept itself has been presented. I've taken this personally to several banks in San Francisco. And why San Francisco? Because they, frankly, have the capacity to be able to handle it. There is a statement, and I guess you don't have it, that tells the concept, if you're not familiar with it, I think Representative Lombard sponsored it, so he is, but that tells the overall concept of it, what it does. But just to touch on it, the pros and cons of it, this is the advantages. The bond measure is not needed through this, as most of you already know. There's not a lump sum payment, such as a house payment. It's paid over a period of time, such as your mortgage payment. It's privately owned, therefore it's subject to tax or property tax, assuming there still is a particular property tax. It could be purchased or maintained by state, county, local government at a later date, and could be purchased by that particular agency at a later date, too. The disadvantages have already been somewhat explored. It's paid for, and you pay it 2.5, 3.5 times over, probably at least. The other part of it is that the constitutional changes in the laws have to be made in order for this type of financing to occur on the state level. Marin County is not the only county to embark upon this type of venture. San Bernardino County in California, largest county in the United States, has floated an investment program for $87 million. It includes a justice center and several other facilities, buildings. It has no jail, however. It has the investment and the owner as a joint partner, and then the county as your principal players. They put together a package over a 30-year period term at 9% with one of the larger brokerage houses. Using the principles of arbitrage, that's the borrowing money, putting these funds back out into the marketplace again, they were able to lower that interest to about 6.8%, of which they've already got it and secured it. This program is clear, but possibly not evenly cut program for financing in the correctional field, or for that fact, any other really facility. It is, though, given the absence of bonding, probably the best route to travel, or at least another option that I would recommend that you give the state of Oregon. And therefore, I ask you to give a due pass to House Bill 2574. Thank you.
Are there any amendments to the bill that either of you believe is necessary? Questions? Thank you, Representative Hill.
Yes, sir. Gary, when you were in San Francisco, just out of curiosity, what type of interest did they talk
about? Interesting. That's very interesting. I first of all touched upon the Toronto Dominion Bank. They had a senior vice president, which I was able to get in to see. They just transferred in from New York City. Now, bear in mind that California has a different type of situation. Proposition 13 is cutting into them, and it's cutting into them very hard. Right now, they are using all kinds of federal funding techniques to do whatever they need to do. Given the absence of bonding, and their bonding is drying up because of Proposition 13, they think this is the route to travel, and they're going to start to implement more and more of this. For your benefit, the officer of the bank looked at it and he said, "You know, young man, that you've probably hit upon a whole different way to finance government." I said, "Not really. It's cash flow. It's like you have to have a cash flow, and you have to be able to preserve that cash flow." And he said, "Yes, but it." And I said, "It's just like a business now." And he said, "That's probably the way you ought to run it." And I said, "But there are different things that one has to try to do from that." So there is a lot of support in that. They think the uniqueness of it will definitely generate into California. It already has to a degree.
I mean, the rate of interest also.
The rate of interest was very hard to tell because we were only in conceptual stage right there, right then. It could go as high as 12%. It could have gone as low, and we were shooting at 8%.
Okay. Thank you very much, Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
House Joint Resolution 25. A look here. Randy Miller and Jim Hill.
Trying not to get it.
Guys are wearing different colored shirts.
Why didn't we schedule this at a time when the cameras were on?
Well, then Peter would have wanted to be on. No, actually, I'm not.
I'm the bill.
Is this the freshman hero bill?
Mr. Chairman.
I'm relieved to see there aren't more than two members of the committee, at least who were named on the bill. I don't know where they serve.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Fine bill, I'm sure.
Mr. Chairman, members of this extraordinarily distinguished committee, for the record, Randy Miller, State Representative, District 24. I'm here on behalf of myself, but also Representative Markham, who expressed his sorrow that he couldn't be here in person to present his usual excellent testimony. But he has provided me something that he would like me to read into the record, and it is very short. He says, for the third consecutive session, I have introduced a bill which would repeal a law that grants immunity from arrest to state legislators during a legislative session. I believe that all citizens should be equal in the eyes of the law. The immunity is written in the Oregon Constitution. Passed by the legislature, the repeal would have to be approved by the voters in the 1984 primary election. This immunity from arrest was granted before the turn of the century. It seems that state legislators traveling to the capital from their hometowns sometimes were arrested to prevent them from attending and voting. Early Oregonians went a bit too far in upholding the saying that no man's life, liberty, or property are safe while the legislature is in session. In the past few sessions, some representatives' and senators' egos have gotten in the way of the fact that legislators simply should not be given special treatment. I hope that egos have shrunk enough for a majority of the legislators to admit that first and foremost, we are citizens of Oregon and should be treated just like every other citizen. That ends Representative Markham's remarks. I generally concur. Now I'll turn it over to Representative Hill.
Do you have a prepared statement of your own wish to make part of the record, or is that?
No, I could certainly run back and prepare one, but knowing how much this committee has to read, I'll defer.
Thank you, Representative Hill. Or, I mean, Representative Miller. Representative Hill?
Yes, thank you very much, Chairman Rutherford. I'm sorry. Jim Hill, State Representative, District 31. I don't have very much to add to what Representative Miller has said for Bill Markham, except that we just should not be in a posture of the ones who pass the laws to expect different treatment under the law. A few weeks ago on 60 Minutes, there was a segment concerning diplomatic immunity and how some of the diplomats did things up to the point of very serious felonies and would be able to escape without retribution. Being here in Salem, where if there's going to be misconduct by legislators, there's a good chance that it will be here. I know that the people in our community would not like to have it that legislators receive special treatment. That's the end of my testimony.
Representative Lombard.
Representative Hill doesn't have to travel down the freeways, however, to go home late on Friday night or get back here. But that's really outside of the question. My question is, I'd like to ask both these gentlemen who their English teachers were, either in college or grade school, or did you have any?
My English. Would you like to take that one first?
English?
Well,
I think
this sentence is an absolute beaut, and I think it, as long as they're amending the Constitution, they've done a magnificent job. Sixth and fifth graders write like this: senators and representatives shall not, for words uttered in debate in either house, be questioned in any other place. Now, I... 10 easy ways, how would you rewrite that so people can understand it? Why didn't you?
That's why we brought it to this committee.
We knew that Representative Lombard had received a better elementary school education. And
I'm troubled that, aside from the grammar, you didn't eradicate that particular immunity also. Isn't that a kind of special privilege?
Maybe that one.
I think we wanted to take it, speaking for myself, just one major step at a time, perhaps.
The incremental theory of it.
For those of us who are back, we might take further steps next session.
Are there further questions of these two fine representatives? Thank you so much for honoring us with your testimony.
Okay. I'd like to, but I don't have enough votes, unfortunately. House Joint Resolution 25 will be transferred to the full committee for hopefully appropriate consideration.
I'm all seriousness. Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm deadly serious. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with the principle of the measure, but I am wondering, do we run the risk of losing the whole thing with the people if we actually just do a little bit of grammatical reconstruction of this thing?
Well, it's tied into Markham's testimony.
It does seem to me that be made much clearer with just a little simple rearranging of the words.
What are you talking about, restoring the deleted language?
No, I'm just saying for the provision that says that we can't be questioned the words uttered in debate in either house. Here you're splitting shall not, and then you're splitting your verb phrase in there. The verb phrase of shall not be questioned, you're splitting with for words uttered in the debate in the house.
I would suggest, Representative Lombard, if you wish, you might work with counsel to prepare an amendment.
I'll ask my fifth grader, who's takes great pride in sentence construction, to rewrite this.
Comments are deeply disturbing. That means there are three members supporting it sitting right here. I mean, two more to go. And maybe some of these others have not spoken yet. So, in any event, it'll be transferred to the full committee later this week, and if there are any amendments, I'd suggest we take that.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be sure to relay Representative Lombard's remarks to Representative Markham. And legislative council.
Now, first of all, I'd like to move to untable all the measures that are before us tonight that are on the table by operation of House rule, and that is everything except 2661, which is not tabled. Is there objection? Okay, they're untabled. Now, first of all, the chair would move that House Bill 2216 be tabled. I might say, for the benefit of Representative Lombard and Courtney, that Mr. Watson joined tonight and requested that bill be tabled. Call the roll.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Okay.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Well, the Senate has passed a measure which Mr. Fletcher brought up dealing with prison industries. And I would suggest that this committee deal with whatever policy statement it wants to make, changes it wants to make in light of that Senate bill. Let's see what that looks like and what areas of concern, either outside or on the committee, it does not address that we might see. So for that reason, I would move that we table the two House bills.
pardon me, I would, we table 2671, and with the understanding we'll take up the issue of prison ministries in the Senate bill.
Okay. That passed the Senate?
Yes, it's completely signed in this committee, as I understand. That's on the understanding also the bill is coming to this committee, which Mr. Fletcher indicated that the Speaker said it would be. That probably wasn't Mr. Fletcher's request. Call roll, please.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Rayner?
Aye.
Myers?
Aye.
Dick, if you understand, would you explain to
my colleague from Dealey Craig?
Yes.
Yes, I'm sorry.
What the tabling is about, I guess, the notice.
I'll tell him we'll request a labor referral on the bill.
Chair, move that House Bill 2574 be reported to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Representative Lombard?
I certainly support that. My question is this the type of measure that should have the perusal of either of the money committees?
Well, I passed Linda a note asking whether it had been subsequently referred to Ways and Means, and she said the answer was no. I would propose we go ahead and report it without that, since that was the Speaker's initial judgment, and we can ask Representative Katz about it, since she's struggling with handle it on the floor. Problem. Further discussion? Call the roll.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Rayner?
No.
Myers?
Aye.
Okay, then House Chair Resolution 25, by virtue of the Chair's authority on the rules to transfer the bills from sub to full, will be just transferred to full for further consideration. Okay, let's go down to our work session, 2589.
Oh, God. Whose name's on this?
Hey, Mr. Chair and committee members, this was a bill that modified, sponsored by Representative Courtney. It modifies the provisions and procedures that have to do with executive clemency and voids the clemency if certain procedures are not followed. At the last hearing, there were some concerns that were raised by the American Civil Liberties Union that they felt that the bill as worded would undermine the ability of the governor to determine the clemency on the merits, and that there could be an especially harsh result if technical procedures were not followed that could then void the clemency even many years afterwards. There was Oregon District Attorneys Association testified in support of the bill. As my records indicate, there was a request for administration's position on this bill and a comment on the time period that's left blank on line 28 of the first page. We did receive a letter dated March 16th from the governor, well, signed by Jim Russell, stating that the governor has reviewed House Bill 2589 and is strongly opposed to its provisions. Because of this opposition, the governor's concluded it would not be appropriate for this office to make a recommendation as to the maximum period that a governor should keep an executive clemency application under advisement.
Are there any amendments proposed to the bill?
No, I don't have anything anything further from on the bill.
Representative Courtney?
For purposes of possible movement, Mr. Chair, it seems to me that obviously 15 and 16 Marion County Amendment, since seemingly an awful lot of people come out of the facilities, or they may have been convicted in another facility, stay here in this area, but I recognize the ACLU testified they were in opposition to that. That might not fly. They also were opposed to lines 8 and 9, which we say if you don't follow the procedures, it's void. I don't have a problem with that, taking those two sections out of it. The only thing I'm trying to do is, what started this whole thing is, the samples case, in that you had a change in district attorneys quite a bit of time from the time Samples filed his initial request to have his sentence commuted or pardoned. And then when the governor got around to his second request, nothing was done to notify the Marion County District Attorney the second time, because that had been done the first time. Now, that is the loophole, the problem we had. It's like there's no limitations on how long the governor has to consider such a request on the part of this person. And while right now in law, and you'll see it,
application or notice of the application, then the obligation to provide records or to respond to the governor's request would arise.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lombard.
Why are we requiring the service of two documents on all these people? The policy issue is that we want to get them to respond. I should think it'd be sufficient, perhaps, if we just amended the whole of 144.650 to say that upon application for pardon, commutation, or remission, that copies of the same shall be served upon, and then list whom you're serving them on.
And they just walk away from it.
Walk away from it.
Don't even say they have to respond, as long as
then you've got 180.
Well, no, I think you put in there on line 20, upon receiving copies of the application, any person or agency named in subsection 1 shall provide the governor's his practical such information, records, etc. I think that's a good public policy statement, Peter, that you made there.
And you can get away from the expiration of 40 days.
Get away from the 40 days thing.
Governor's got 180 days.
That's really up to the governor, it seems to me, how long he waits or she waits until the agencies and persons respond.
All right, let's require that the proof by affidavit that the service of the application, filing the application of the governor, will be covered by proof of the service of the application on the others. Yeah, that's simpler, I think.
Hey,
Representative Hill?
I agree, but let me at least comment now. The situation that that Peter is concerned about, he's talking about when there was a possible change in DA also. Now, at least in my way of thinking, suppose you had a situation, especially given you throwing in another 180 days, the person sends a notice to the district attorney, there's a change in district attorneys, and then there's no notice provided to the new district attorney that an actual, which is truly the key, is the actual application for commutation of whatever has been received. Now, I mean, I guess I wonder then for the DA in that position, how you could have a situation where the DA may have known before taking office this application, he was served an application, a notice of intent to apply, and doesn't hear anything else. But if the DA also gets a notice of the actual application or a copy of the actual application for, then he's on notice and can comment. He or she is on notice and can comment.
Mr. Chairman, I think the only thing, if the provision in its current form right now, the law today provides, is it provides somehow a 20-day notice period before an application is made and is a notice to the agencies and these other persons to get their information in. I really don't see But in the context of changing offices, if this is going to make any great difference, I think the context of changing offices, I suppose, where you run into that problem, is if you waited too long for something to be acted upon. But my gosh, it doesn't seem to me that we should be putting the burden on the applicant to check on a day-to-day basis to see if there's somebody new in that office.
Well, not on it. Well, the only thing you're doing is requiring that they receive a notice of the actual application,
yeah, which they should put in the file. You know, the DA should receive that notice of, should receive the copy of the application, put that in their to-do file, and they better get on with it.
Yes, well, I guess the only situation I'm contemplating is if you have a situation where you have a DA who is leaving office. Okay. We don't know how many of these things are going to be received. I don't know how many applications that the governor receives. It may be, if there are a lot of these, it may get to the point where the district attorneys will not respond to them until there is an actual application.
That's right. All we're saying is once the application's filed, you guys get busy, respond. Well, and if something doesn't happen in 6 months, then we start all over. I think that's your protection, the 6 month thing.
If you have a change in the DA who was in office doesn't do anything.
That's right.
Okay, a new DA comes in,
hopefully
receives no notice. Well, hopefully. That's right. Underline that. Hopefully. We'll hopefully receives it. if they don't receive it, the actual application goes to the governor, not to the district attorney. The governor commutes, and then we're in a situation like what
we're requiring the actual application go to the district attorney.
Actual application?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Copies of the actual application.
Okay, not the not just a
notice. Actual application. I'm saying, geez, we can't. I don't think we can put in legislation here that, geez, if there's a new DA, the old DA has got to turn over his records to the new DA.
Linda's passed me a note. You know, she said there was the point of the bill to assure agency had time to get comments in before Governor Mike Graham pardoned.
Well, I think the governor, if the governor is wise, the governor will. First of all, the governor will have the affidavit upon whom service was made. It seems to me that any governor worth a damn is going to, if they don't hear from these people, they're going to have to call them up to find out. Otherwise, they're subject to and entitled to the criticism they get.
Further discussion of the bill as amended? Are we clear on the amendments?
What was your final?
Okay, we're going to delete lines 8 and 9. Okay. We're going to strike out all concept of prior notice of intention to apply and simply provide that the application itself will be served on those entities noted.
Okay, no more notice of intent. Okay.
Then,
all those people would just be, the people that are listed there would be receiving actual notice of an application.
The application itself. They will receive the application.
They will receive a copy of the application.
Lines 20 through, line 20 will go back to its present form. Line 19, you'll still have, I think, spelling out a little bit more the requirement to accompany the application of the governor be accompanied by the proof of service on those others.
I think actually line 20 is a copy now of the application.
Yes.
So instead of intention to apply, it's a copy of the actual application coming forward.
Okay.
What line?
well, line 20, upon receiving a copy of the application, so because we're requiring that now in the above sections.
We'll strike 24 through 26. We'll insert 180 days on line 28. Do you have them all over?
Yeah.
Chair moves the adoption of the amendments. Is there any objection? Chair moves that House Bill 2589 as amended be reported to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
Just a quick question.
The
current law says shall be served. Are we talking about, and I'm just ignorant in this area, personal service only? Or are we talking about certified mail? And because I assume the states happen to pay for the service. I don't know how the inmate would. Seems to me we've tried to go in the direction of providing the option for certified mail to reduce service costs.
That's fine.
I don't even know if it has to be certified mail if it doesn't specify certified mail.
I don't think it does. You want it to be?
I don't care. I just want to provide an option other than personal service because there's a cost involved. And I'm not sure if the language is silent when it just says serve, that assumes service. Personal service or is it assumed it can be mail or manner provided by law.
I think we require the affidavit of service by mailing or otherwise. That should cover that.
That's fine.
That should cover it.
Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Mayor?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
2661.
Gone through some changes along the way. It's a felony sex offender registration bill. At one point, the committee had adopted the amendments 2661-2 dated April 6, 1983, which basically adds to the list of felony sex offenses using a child in an obscene sexual performance, promoting an obscene sexual performance by a child, incest or compelling prostitution. And also throughout, it substitutes for Department of Justice, the State Police Bureau of Criminal Identification, who would have a responsibility for administration of this. At the last meeting, there was a conceptual amendment, and I don't have noted whether it was adopted by Representative Lombard, that the bill be amended to require registration only prospectively, so that it would apply to individuals convicted after October 1, 1983, or who were convicted before but released from custody after that date. There were some questions then raised about a five-year limitation on the time period that the record may be kept, and it brought up two questions. One is how long, are we talking about how long the individual has an obligation to report, as well as how long the record would be kept by the agency with which the person registered. There were two things going on. One was that the case from California we requested, we have never received. I haven't gotten it yet. I don't know if either whether it's on its way, but it hasn't arrived. I can't give any clearer picture of what exactly the issue was there. The committee noted that we should focus on the question of the time of retaining the records, and to check on the California case. And also the committee said that if it seemed like we needed a limitation, could there be some ideas provided of how that might be framed to cover how long there would be a requirement to retain the registration and how to deal with a person whose parole might be revoked, what to do with subsequent offenses. Again, I haven't had any sort of extensive time in which to do further research, and I don't have the California case, but I did take a look at some of the provisions of the California statute. Some of the sections of this bill really come from that, are very closely aligned to that statute. Obviously, they have like a mandatory imprisonment for a person that doesn't comply, which is not picked up in this bill. There was another a part that they have that you may want to think about is that they allow a person, and I don't have the citation from their statutes to this section of it, but they have a provision that says a person required to register under Section 290 may initiate a proceeding under this other chapter, and upon obtaining a certificate of rehabilitation shall be relieved of any further duty to register under the section. Now, we don't, that would mean a whole process, and I haven't looked at all at what their process is all about. What I did discuss with legislative counsel is how we might frame the prospective part of applying this to persons who are either presently in the custody or later commit the offense. And he had suggested that rather than have these blanks with the date put in there, that we say that any person, language to the effect of in Section 3, we'd be deleting subsection 2, which had addressed the persons that were convicted before the effective date of the act. And subsection 1 could read something like any person convicted. Any person released from the corrections division or a county jail or discharged from probation or parole. Oh, no, I can't read my writing. After person released from the corrections division or county jail or discharged from probation or parole after the effective date of this act somewhere here I have this phrase now it's not fitting in quite right but or following conviction for a felony sex offense it would fit in so both of those would have to do with the effective date of the act and then make the effective date, you make an emergency clause and make the effective date October 1, 1983 and apply it to persons who are who have been convicted or released from the corrections division or county jail or discharged from probation or parole following the effective after the effective date of the act. And as far as
let's
any
see
of the
if
other
there's discussion of that amendment first. Representative Lombard,
let me suggest that we do it in this one. Why don't we make the operative provision in Section 3 to simply say any person convicted of any felony sex offense or a felonious attempt to commit any felony sex offense shall register as a felony sex offender with the chief of police of the city in which the person resides or the sheriff of the county if the person resides in an unincorporated area. Period. And then at the end of the bill, add a provision that this law shall apply to convicted sex offenders defined in Section 3, who are either convicted after the effective date of this law, or convicted prior to the effective date of this law, but released in the custody of the Corrections Division, or the language, operating language that you're using there. Seems to me it's more appropriate to do it that way than to try to put that language into Section 3. We've done that with other criminal law statutes where we've enhanced penalties or where we've created new crimes. Basically said it applies to persons who commit offenses after the effective date of this law.
Discussion of that amendment? Is there objection? Okay. Let's see, the previous amendments, dash 2, had added certain offenses to the definition under subsection, or under Section 2. Let's just take the remaining sections in order. Section 4.
Would say, Mr. Chair, that the amendment similar to my amendments, Section 3, should apply here. And that is to put your operative language in this section to say that any person determined to be not responsible for a felony sex offense, there is no penalty for disease or defect, or conflict amendment based on a sanity statute, is required to register, and then to put again in the effective date provision language to the effect that it applies to individuals who are either determined to be not responsible after the effective date of this, or individuals who are determined prior to that date but who are released from any institution, hospital, or other facility to which they were committed subsequent to the effective date.
Discussion? Taking that as a motion, is there objection?
Yep.
All right. Lombard, did you have any further amendments?
I scanned the rest of the bill. I read it before and read notes. I really don't see anything that needs to be done, although I want to give staff the authority to make any corresponding changes in sections 5 through 10, and then I think we'll have I understand my amendments. You'll add a section 11 that will provide food that applies on the effective date.
I'd like to move that we add an amendment.
Can I raise one question?
Yeah, come on, Stevie. I'd like to move that we add, for purposes of review at the full committee, some process analogous to that in California by which one can obtain a certificate which terminates the obligation to fully register.
Okay.
Did I describe accurately what you were talking about earlier?
Do you want an amendment setting up such a procedure?
Yes. we'll get you some research help on this. That's the vibe I'm getting back. Stevie?
Stevie Remington from ACLU of Oregon. I wanted to raise a question. The language reads, any person convicted of specific offenses. And I'm not sure whether it's your intent to, and I don't think the bill makes clear, whether these are convictions in Oregon only. For instance, on Section 5, any person who is discharged or paroled from a jail, prison, or other institution. What about people that are convicted of other states under other laws? And I'm thinking in particular of some states which have laws that make felonies perhaps out of something which is not even a crime in this state. And whether the police could then identify whether it's the equivalent of a crime that we define or not an equivalent, what do you do with out-of-state people? And how do they get notice like the Department of Justice?
You know what California does?
Well, as a matter of fact, California has a provision that says, let me see where the sentence starts here. It's a long sentence. This is real long. If I could just read this. It seems to be one sentence in a long paragraph. Any person who since the first day of July 1944 has been or is hereafter convicted in the state of California of the offense of assault with intent to commit rape, the infamous crime against nature, or sodomy under blah, blah, blah sections, or of any offense involving lewd and lascivious conduct under Section 272, or any person who since such date has been or is hereafter convicted of the attempt to commit any of the above-mentioned offenses, or any person who since such date or at any time thereafter is discharged or paroled from a penal institution where he was confined because of the commission of an attempt to commit one of the above-mentioned offenses, or any person who since that's mentally disordered sex offender, or any person who has been since such date or is hereafter convicted in any other state of any offense which if committed or attempted in this state would have been punishable as one or more of the above mentioned offenses shall within 30 days after the effective date of this section or within 30 days of his coming into any county or city and county in which he resides or is temporarily domiciled such length of time registered with chief of police and so forth.
How was it?
Can you repeat that idea?
How were they notified again? They were notified.
I don't know about the notification of persons from other states as to that obligation.
And in-state was what? I'm sorry. What violation?
Oh, there are lots and lots of sections that have to do with a duty to notify by the penal institution.
Okay.
That the person has a requirement to register. I'm not sure how they pick up on the out-of-state people as far as them getting actual notice of this duty to register.
Thank you, Steve.
Nothing's but no thanks.
Your amendment is.
Take a look at
Well, it's late. We're all tired. Chair would move that the bill be amended to provide for the requirement to extend to convictions and releases in Oregon. If there's some way to modify it further, I suppose we can consider that later.
To extend to convictions or releases in Oregon?
In Oregon.
But people transferred, you mean, from another jurisdiction?
Transferred. What do you mean? Well,
I didn't understand that.
Released, convicted, or released. Convicted in Oregon and.
Oh, that it's being restricted to persons.
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying expanded to.
Objection. Further discussion of the bill as amended? Lombard.
Move it to the...
Lombard moves House Bill 2661 as amended be reported to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye. The committee going short.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Springer?
No.
Meyer?
No votes, Springer.
Ted Springer, don't have any other parentheses right here. Ready for your name?
There's nothing to his madness. He won't have to carry it.
I'd like to move half the committee going shock. The rest is up. Several of us go in shock.
You gotta carry that.
Peter, now what meeting are you fellas gonna do now?
It's almost half two, right?
Sure. Now, let's see, we have another meeting.
I wouldn't tell anyone else on that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, keep in mind that that's Troop's bill. If he wants to, no one here wants to carry it. Troop would love to have.